situation.
Through a series of connections, I got into working for a farmer's insurance agent. It took a half a cut in pay to go be a CSR just because I needed the break. And I learned insurance and I really liked it, and I was doing really well, or he was doing really well. I was helping him do very well. And then I wanted to get out on my own. And so I had found that I had understood the insurance side of things pretty well. So I did a lot of life insurance sales, and I was going in back in the late 90s. Long-term care insurance was pretty much the thing. It was fairly popular, coming onto the scene. So I learned the long-term care insurance industry.
You haven't gone through insurance yet.
Oh, you
so
haven't.
They may not know what long-term care
insurance is. Oh, okay. Long-term care. It's so funny. I say it quickly. When I used to do phone sales, older people would think, what, lawn care? I'm like, I'm not calling for lawn care. It was long-term care. Y'all know what long-term care is? It's that insurance, or you transfer the risk to an insurance company in case you ever need to have someone take care of you.
It's not medical.
And it's not disability.
To help you do your daily things like getting dressed,
eating,
bathing,
toileting,
preparing
training,
meals,
transferring,
yes.
Maintaining continence. Yeah.
That's the name, long-term care.
Long-term care. Yes. Long-term care. Lawn care.
Yes.
Long-term care. Yeah. So I got into long-term. Keep bumping into the thing. Long-term care sales. And I already had my life insurance license because I had been working for the farmer's insurance agent. And so because I was talking to people about finance, a natural thing that came up was, can you help me with this rollover? Or I'm getting an inheritance or something like that. So I got my investment licenses in 1999. So I have, how familiar are you with the investment world or how my world works? Oh, should I kind of go over
that?
Sorry, this class, you guys are early. Yeah, I usually speak to you when you're a little later. So in my business, you typically have your investment licenses and your insurance licenses. So I have my insurance license, what I've had forever, which was the easy part of my business. And then the investment licenses, I have a Series 6, a Series 63, and a Series 65 license. The 6 and 63 allow me to transact in the mutual fund and variable annuity world. The 65 license allows me to charge for my time, so I can charge an hourly rate or a flat rate, which is what I do, and I'll get into that in a little bit. And then my partner, Rob, has the Series 7 license. Series 7 license allows you to transact individual stocks and bonds. And he specifically got it so that we could do what are called 1031 exchanges. Have you covered that yet? Okay, 1031 exchanges are when someone sells an appreciated piece of property that is not their personal residence. They have a large capital gain. The IRS allows you to defer taxes on the capital gain if you buy another like piece of property. In our world, we don't transact in property. We transact in real estate investment trusts, which are also known as REITs. And so because we work in an ag area and we're fairly well connected with a lot of people in real estate, put ourselves out as helping people defer capital gains through 1031 exchanges, and a good realtor will know what that is. And we work with a couple of really good realtors. So we haven't finished a transaction yet, kind of getting it out there and letting people know that it's there and that we're in Hanford and able to do it, because it's a fairly sophisticated concept that doesn't happen a whole lot in the Hanford and Visalia area. They're mostly Fresno, LA, and people come from out of the area to do it. So we're positioning ourselves in this area as 1031 experts. So in our business, you know, when people get older, they've got property, they've got rental properties, and maybe they've inherited land or they have land and it's appreciated, and if they sell it, they're whopped with a capital gain, so they want to defer that, and we use 1031s. So Rob's really focusing on the 1031 area. We can do stocks and bonds if we need to, but because we function in a planning capacity, we don't want to be selling individual stocks and bonds because it's too much liability and responsibility. So if someone has a portfolio, we will handle it for them, but we don't sell to them specifically on that level. So I just back to the beginning, got into the business, got my investment licenses, I was a John Hancock representative for a few years, so back in the day, way before most of you were born, the life insurance companies were the training programs for a lot of people in the financial services circuit. So there was New York Life, Principal, Mass Mutual, and John Hancock, who were the big players around here. So I interviewed with all four of them, which was kind of fun because I had my life licenses and everybody wanted me because they didn't have to train me because I had already come in with the ability to talk life insurance. chose to go with John Hancock because they had an aspect to their program that said if somebody didn't fit the John Hancock model, I could go outside and help them. The other three channels didn't have that flexibility, and I did not want to be like stuck in a channel where I had to do what this, you know, system said I had to do. So I worked through John Hancock for a couple of years. My parents were some of my first clients because they wanted long-term care insurance. They actually kind of helped me get into it without knowing it because they'd asked me about it, and I said, I'm thinking of doing that. Wait, and I'll get my license. And then they were literally my first long-term care clients. So it's a great selling point when I work with people who are interested in long-term care to say, my parents have long-term care so that I can take them to the movies and someone else can take them to the potty. And so it kind of makes sense. So hopefully we won't ever have to use it. But anyway, long story short, that's how I got into the business. And just from, I've been pretty much self-taught. I've stayed in a lot of classes. I have educated myself through industry programs. I have those initials behind my name. LUTCF, which is a life insurance training program that also incorporates financial planning. I have the RICP, which is Retirement Income Certified Professional. I have a BFA, which is a Behavioral Financial Analyst. It's more of a certificate, but it was a great program. And then I just finished my Certified Divorce Financial Analyst designation last year, which is a certification specific to a divorce situation. So I do not have a CFP. I get asked that every now and then. I probably will never have my CFP because I'm really sick of taking tests. And it's a long-term program. It's a couple of years. I'm licensed just like a CFP, and I can do all the stuff that CFP people do, so I don't feel that going through that, the rigors of CFP, is really worth my time right now. My business is fairly well established. Rob and I manage about $30 million right now of client money. We focus primarily on planning. We hire out our investment management through third-party asset managers, which you'll probably talk about in this class, which just means it's different than a mutual fund. Are you all familiar with how mutual funds work, basically, kind of how mutual funds work? So we build mutual fund portfolios for a certain level of clients, and then we also, for another level of clients, we hire a third-party manager to manage to an objective. We charge a fee of 1% if we're using third-party manager, so that's 1% of assets under management. In addition to a planning fee, depending on the level of work that someone needs to have done. So if they come to us and they need a retirement rollover and it's fairly small, or they need a college planning thing put together for their child, then that's a smaller planning fee than a full-blown package planning fee. Our minimum fee is $250, and our maximum fee right now is $1,500. $1,500 is a pretty involved package, and it's really a bargain for a lot of people in this area because most you go outside and it's $2,400 to $3,000 somewhere else. We'll be at that level in the future when we feel like it's time to go there, but right now $1,500 works pretty well. It's a one-time fee for clients. We explain going in it's one-time fee. The only time we would charge an additional planning fee is if they came to us with additional needs. So if it's a couple and they get divorced and we have to help them, one of them through a divorce, and we plan charge for a divorce planning thing. If they receive an inheritance and need some help sorting that out, we charge for that. If there's a widow situation where one dies, we charge to sort that out. Because all that stuff is complicated and time-consuming. Probably the most time-consuming ones I work on are the death situations, because gathering assets and finding assets and getting claims paid and all that is a very long process to make sure everything's done correctly. And what's the most difficult part of all of it? Anyone want to take a guess?
The grieving?
Managing the behavior. Yeah. People in grief do crazy things with their money. And so, you know, I kind of say I'm the person that's going to throw myself between you and the bus and make sure that you don't do something crazy with your money. If I can get to you before you've done something crazy with your money, mm-hmm. and otherwise I'm going to have to, you know, straighten it all out. And I have to do that sometimes because, unfortunately, the grief just does, you don't think straight through grief. And if there's already bad habits in place, they'll get worse when the person is going through a grieving situation. So anyway, so that's kind of the basics of, you know, what I do and what I'm all about. I absolutely love what I do. It's never the same day twice because you're dealing with people and their money and their experiences and their hopes and dreams, and you know, it's just, it's so much fun to hear and to be involved in clients' lives and be a part of what, you know, makes things happen for them. Finance is a complicated world unless you live in it like Mrs. Hott does, but for the most part, it's a very complicated world and a lot of people don't understand it. And it's fun helping folks sort that out and, you know, put a plan together and have a vision for their future. So I'll kind of stop right there and let's let the, maybe some questions. Anybody have any questions?
How did the divorce insurance work?
You mean how does divorce planning work?
Yeah.
Divorce planning is a whole other animal. Having been through divorce myself, that was what prompted me to get my divorce financial analyst. You help folks sort out who gets what. That's part of it. But and attorneys do that. That they're, you know, attorneys are really good at, you know, putting out the ledger and it goes on each side. But I'm the one that comes in and says, okay, this may not be a good idea, and this is why. If you're going to do this, then we calculate into the future. CPAs and attorneys don't calculate into the future. They also don't do forensics on tax returns, which I have not done yet, but I'm trained to do it, and I have lots of resources in my business and people that I know that do this, so you can dig into tax returns in case you know think that somebody's not telling the truth. And typically in divorce, people don't tell the truth. My ex didn't tell the truth, and he divorced the wrong person because I knew where to find it. And so I had some personal experience, which is always a good motivator for, you know, what you want to do. And unfortunately, I have some clients that just finished a divorce, and one client asked me about an asset, and then I had to go ask the other client. They both have stayed my clients. I had to ask the other client, did you disclose this asset? Because it's over here, and she's asking about it, and he said he didn't. And I said, okay. My advice is you play nice about this asset, because the rules are if you don't disclose an asset and the other spouse finds out about it, they get it 100%. And he didn't like that information, but I said, look, I'm just a messenger, and it's cheaper for you to play nice with the asset than it is to turn it over, you know, and play nice with it. So it's kind of fun to know those rules and, you know, and walk people through that. So I'm new in it. I haven't done any extensive divorce cases. I've met with two people so far and just kind of walk them through.
Is it good to get one in the beginning of the divorce?
It's best to get one in the beginning. You can also get one in the during. Sometimes it's too late after, unless there's what are called quadros in place and you need some help, you know, with the quadro division of assets. Quadros, qualified domestic relations order. That's when the marital settlement agreement says you get half of this, say 401k or pension. The quadro will divide that. And then it has to go to a whole other level with another attorney and another person dividing the asset and payment and all that kind of stuff. So it's best to get one in the beginning or during. So, good question. Another question?
What's the process for getting like your Series 7, Series 6 certification?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a great question. So you self-study for them, typically. Series 7s, you can take crash courses in them for a week or two and then just sit down and take the test, because it's a six-hour test to take the Series 7. But you typically cannot get your license until you are connected to a broker-dealer. Are you all familiar with what a broker-dealer is? So in my world, I'm supervised. Everybody in my world that has a license has to be supervised by a broker-dealer. So it's like a realtor that's connected to Keller Williams or Realty World or something like that. They're the supervising broker. So the hierarchy is you have to be supervised. So you have to connect to a broker-dealer to have your license activated, because you can't transact without being supervised. So you self-study, and then you connect to a broker-dealer. And then once you're connected to the broker-dealer, you can activate your license, and you have to pay to have them supervise you.
Oh.
Yeah. So my minimum fees, my back office fees are about $500 a month to be supervised. So you have to pay for errors and omissions insurance. You have to pay what are called platform fees, which means that in order to transact products across the platform, you have to be supervised, and so the platform fees are included in that. Then there's technology fees and so forth, you know, for to have internet access and all that kind of stuff. So, and the payouts will vary depending on how much business you produce. So in the independent world, which is where I live and work, as opposed to the non-independent world, so the non-independent world would be like Merrill Lynch, Dean Witter, Morgan Stanley, Stephen Nicholas. Those are what we call wirehouses. And those are typically very well-defined environments in which people work, as opposed to an independent environment, which is where I work. I can pretty much go out to the marketplace as long as my broker-dealer has it on their platform, and independents tend to have a very broad array of services and products on their platform as opposed to wirehouses. My production in our case, they take 10% of our overall production to supervise us. And so that's our cost for doing the business. So our payouts will be at 90% of whatever the commission or the fee is on an annual basis, in addition to some other annual fees and tests and branch office inspections and things you have to do. So the compensation in our business is really good if you stick with it and you go over the long term. It's very tough in the beginning to get started in this business, because unfortunately there aren't a lot of insurance companies providing subsidized salary situations, which is how I started off. You pretty much have to connect with somebody who's established like me. So my partner Rob, who also went to the same college I did, but we didn't know each other. It's kind of an irony, and I'm 3 years older than he is, but we have that fun connection there with the college thing. He had been in the business 20 years ago and got out, did a lot of other work, and then came back in, but he could not just start in the business, just put a shingle out, because you have to be supervised by somebody. So I'm technically the supervisor, and because of me, he gets a higher payout because they aggregate our production. Otherwise, he would be at typically a 50 or a 60% payout because he's starting out. So you have to have production levels, meet production levels before you make more money. Yes.
So why does somebody have to be supervised?
Because you're dealing with people's money.
No, and the law dictates this?
Yes.
Supervision?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a federal requirement. So you can't have an investment license without being connected to a supervising broker dealer. Trying to limit the Bernie Madoffs out there. I'm not smart enough to be Bernie Madoff. And people question me and they say, well, how do I know that this is, you know, this money? And first of all, no one ever, ever, ever writes a check to me. They never write a check to Athena Financial Group. So if they're writing the $1,500 planning fee check, they write it to my back office. And my back office takes their 10% cut and gives me the remaining 90%. So absolutely everything is supervised.
So who is supervising Bernie?
There was a broker-dealer supervising him, and there's an interesting story.
Want.
Yeah, I know. Actually, those people
they
were handed a map and a flashlight to, you know, they knew, and they were being told, and the SEC dropped the ball on that one. That was a pretty bad one. The interesting thing is if you keep up on the news, there are Ponzi schemes that come out every so many months. Someone's busting another Ponzi scheme. It's like, we haven't figured this one out, you know, but they tighten the net, and those guys still get around it. If it sounds too good to be true, it is. So it's true. It's really true on that end of things. So, another question? Yeah.
What are some obvious Ponzi schemes that we can avoid? Or what are some telltale signs that it's a scheme?
If someone's promising you a rate of return of a certain amount, yeah.
Okay.
Never, ever, ever take the word promise in a situation. The only time the word guarantee can be used is if it's actually guaranteed, and the only thing that guarantees returns are bank products or insurance products, and that's okay because they're contractually guaranteed. Insurance products are contractually guaranteed. In the investment world, nothing is guaranteed, except
annuities.
That it'll change.
Annuities have some.
Annuities are insurance products, yes. So annuities have guarantees, so it's okay to say this is guaranteed, and it's contractual, and it's written down, and here's where it is. But in the investment world, it's never guaranteed, other than it will guarantee it to change. Guaranteed to change. It's a good question, though. And if it doesn't feel right, don't do it. Absolutely, if it doesn't feel right, don't do it. Yeah. Transparency is a big one, too. We'll get to that.
How long do you have to be supervised?
Pardon me?
How long do you have to be supervised?
Forever.
Forever?
Yeah, forever. I haven't earned my way out of it yet. No. And, you want to be supervised because, if the client gets upset and they come after you and they want to sue you, you've got your back office, ideally, to, help you with your documentation and everything. So that's a good question, because what Rob and I do is we repeat our process. So we say the same thing every time to people as much as we can, and then we write it down. Because if you're ever, you know, I learned this a long time ago from the farmer's insurance guy that I was working for, because I asked him some questions like, well, what if? And he said, here's why. If you always say the same thing, if you're deposed, then you can call in other clients, and the other clients say, well, they always, you know, they've always said that to me, or she's always said that to me. So Rob and I are pretty consistent about what we say to folks, and we're really good at documenting things. I'm really good at documenting things because I'm always worried about, you know, getting hit by a bus and somebody not knowing where I was with a client. So Rob, being my succession plan, if something happened, he can open the file, our electronic file, and know exactly where I was with the client and what we were doing. So pretty anal about that end of things. So, but yeah, you never get out of supervision until you retire your licenses.
So say I was a first-time client and I just want to start to invest a little bit for a future long-term wealth, what are a couple recommendations you would give me?
First of all, start. Well, that's good. So all of you in here are so young, so start. You can usually start in the mutual fund world with $50 a month. You don't need an initial investment of $1,200, which is what you need typically, about around $1,000 if you're going to do a one-time. But $50 a month, the investment companies will waive the initial if you start with the minimum. And then you do it every month. And you just do, and you increase as much as you can as you go along. What's the benefit of doing investing once every month at the same time of the month?
Compounding
and your dollar cost averaging. So you're buying high and you're buying low, and your overall average cost is lower, because when is it best to buy in the market? When it's low, right? Okay, so if you're at dollar cost averaging, you're buying low. If you work for an employer and you have an access to a 401k or a 403b, absolutely, 120%, please take advantage of that, even if it's only $50. Because number one, it comes off the top of your check, so that's before you pay taxes on it. Your impact will only be about, for $100, will only be about $70 in your take-home pay, but it will be $100 into your 401k or 403b. 401k is private employer, 403b is working for a school. Same thing, same limits, which are really large, and the ability to do it before taxes. So, yeah.
I had a question about, what do you think about trading platforms such as Robinhood versus the traditional trading mm-hmm. platforms of E-Trade and Ameritrade, you know, with the, mm-hmm. the no-fee transactions, mm-hmm. which helps the smaller mm-hmm. investors?
It does, yeah.
What's your take on that?
You know, Robinhood intrigues me because I've heard about it. I hear it on my podcast, yeah, and I haven't dug into it yet. Whenever a client asks me, hey, I want to buy XYZ for whatever reason, I say, that's great. Go to E-Trade or Ameritrade. It's low cost. It's all in your control, and it's transparent. So I think Robinhood has smaller minimums or something.
Yeah,
or something different.
It's essentially each transaction is
yeah.
No fee. There's no fees.
Yeah.
So,
there's fees somewhere in there, so don't get all dazzled by the no fee, because everyone's got to eat, right? You know,
I pay $10 a month.
Yeah, that's pretty, yeah. What do you know about Robinhood?
Oh, I see a lot of people lose a lot of money on it. Because, like, people like don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Get opened up to like options and stuff way
yeah.
too early.
Oh yeah.
So instead of knowing what they're doing, and they like
yeah, you're getting into options. You don't know what you're doing, especially
yeah. You
got don't get into options.
I trade options.
Yeah. Well, if you know what you're doing, that's fine. You know, but don't start with options. Start with buying some stock in your favorite company or something that you really love. You know, if you can afford to lose, and only do what you can afford to lose, right? Because, you know, it's all in with a stock. You know, you've got to go all in. If you love whatever and it goes away, it's gone. If you buy it in a mutual fund, you're getting a share of it, and much less chance of you losing all of it, because the mutual fund is comprised of fractions of shares of a whole bunch of different companies, and not all of them are going to go down at once or go away at once. Yeah.
And why is it better to hold long-term stocks instead of doing short-term? I heard something that involves taxes.
Yes, in a non-qualified situation, so non-IRA or non-retirement situation, that's what we call non-qualified. And if you're buying and selling in a non-qualified situation, you're probably incurring capital gains. You're incurring capital gains, you're going to pay taxes on your gains.
We just went over taxes and the differences between long-term and short-term capital gains.
Inside of a year, short-term, outside of a year, long-term. So not a bad thing if it's a part of your portfolio. So I work on a pyramid situation with clients, just a second. I work on a pyramid, so I say, you know, here's your savings. That's the first thing. Actually, insurance is the bottom. Then savings. Then group retirement plans. So if you have a 401k, 403b, do that first. If you don't, then we go to IRAs. And then after that, I'll get this question a lot. I want to start saving for my kids' college. I said, that's great. What have you done in your 401k? Well, nothing. I said, uh-uh. No scholarships for old age. We start with you first. Then after you get yours started, I don't require full funding because you got to have, you know, some traction. Then we go up to college funding after that. So then after that, then I say, and if you want to buy stock in your favorite tech company, go do it through E-Trade or Ameritrade and do it yourself and only do what you can afford to lose. So, yeah.
What's your take on cryptocurrency?
It scares me. Yeah. Let that guy just die with all the passwords, right? I mean, oh, heck no. I think it's too young, personally. I think it's too young.
You don't think it's a...
I don't deal in it. I am I'm boring. I'm really conservative.
Bitcoin.
No, I don't do any of it. I get asked about it, and Rob gets asked about it, and we just kind of say, you know, you do that on your own. We don't want fiduciary liability or any responsibility for that. Yeah, but a good question. Your generation is going to be all into that. You know, I deal mostly with... You know, dinosaurs like myself are older, so, you know, we're all still fairly traditional. I've got a handful of clients your age, children of clients and younger clients, and so I'm having to adapt and kind of get into your mindset, but for the most part, I'm fairly traditional, and some of that stuff has worked for a long time. We, you know, things are changing. We do add in some of the new stuff, but anything like that, we just say, you're on your own. Yeah.
To stay up to date on investing, what are a couple good sources, new sources or outlets to keep looking at to stay updated?
I like Kiplinger, and I subscribe to Investopedia. Yeah. They give you the word of the day, which is kind of fun, you know, so you get the term of the day so you can be familiar with how things work. I'd say stay away from Money Magazine because it's really geared towards selling stuff. And, you know, Rob, my partner, loves to say, yeah, if you'd bought everything Money Magazine recommended, you'd have no money, you know, because they're just pushing the next, you know, flavor of the day, you know, so they're driven by advertising dollars. So, well, they have some good concepts in there about, you know, Roth versus traditional IRA and why you need this much life insurance, all that kind of stuff. Their planning stuff is good, but I'd stay away from their recommendations.
If you just want to track, even Yahoo Finance.
Mm-hmm. Yahoo Finance is good.
You
yeah,
can put in a portfolio that of things you really own, or you can even put together a portfolio of things you might be interested in. Mm-hmm. Track it for a while, see how
works.
You do.
And for a while, I would say at least a year. You know, I love your questions. You know, you have to remember when you're investing, you've got to have a minimum of 2 years, minimum. Otherwise, you're saving. You know, you can't, and I like people to think in terms of 5 years. Not hard to do with older clients, but you younger folks, man, it's hard to get you to think past next week sometimes. So, you know, you got to think 5 years or more. That's an investment. You know, anything inside of that is savings. So you don't want to invest anything that you need inside of 5 years. You've got to give the market time to do its stuff. You got to let it go down. You got to be ready to push more money in when it goes down because that's a buying opportunity. All the smart people stay in when the market goes down. All the, you know, not so smart people get out when it goes down. They get out when it goes down instead of staying in or buying more. So I took a huge group of clients through 2008. I lost one. I fired one and I lost one. And the one that got out voluntarily called me after he got out and I said, why did you do that? And he said, have you seen the market? I said, yes, but there go all your dividends. You were getting dividends on that account regardless of the value of the account. What was that?
What year was it?
That was in 2008.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 2008, 2009. And everybody that's
a big
stayed in,
drop.
It was a big drop.
50%, right?
It was 40, about 40 with most of my portfolios. But, you know, you stay in. Nobody in my book needed their money right then. Nobody did. So that's where in this business, you know, the way I'm different than somebody maybe that works at Merrill or Dean or Stifel is that, and they are very good at this as well, but we're behavior managers. You know, that's primarily what we do is we keep people invested. We help them understand why. We make sure that, you know, you don't get short-sighted on things. It's okay. You've got this much cash on the front end. This is two or 3 years worth of cash or very short-term, relatively conservative investments. Then, you know, your long-term stuff is taking the ride, but the plan on the long-term stuff is this number. And, you know, we can peg it to that. So it's a big, you know, a big part of our job is behavior management. That's why we have decided that we don't do a lot of portfolio construction and technical work. We hire that out because we're spending so much time planning and charting and interacting with clients that, you know, we don't have time to sit there and manage all the little things, so we hire that piece of it out. That's kind of the way the world in my world is going. So, did you have another question?
Like somebody like me, this beginner, where would I go to start, like to invest?
You could do it on your own if you wanted, depending on what you wanted. A lot of the fund sites will have a do-it-yourself option. I mean, you can research, you know, what would be something along your lines. You have to think in terms of how old you are and what your objective is. And then you pick your portfolio. Typically, if you're young and you've got a long time horizon, you would look towards something growth-oriented. You can go, you know, to the Vanguard and Schwab sites. They have a lot of good do-it-yourself stuff. If you start with somebody like me, you know, there's going to be a setup fee, and we disclose all of our fees and commissions to clients. So we do act as fiduciaries. That was a question in your last class. So we are fiduciaries, so we disclose this is what you're paying to use me, this is what I'm making off of this, and you know, it's all out there. You know, I always just kind of laugh in my head because I think, you know, we all use the banks, but the banks don't tell us how much they're making off of us. Sometimes it's a lot of money, but we tell everybody, you know, what they're paying us. If it's a commission-based product, we disclose what the commission is. If it's on an insurance product or a fund, and then if it's fees, then we say these are our fees and these are the third-party manager fees.
I recently started dabbling in artificial intelligence stocks. Mm-hmm. Do you think within the next 10 to 20 years, do you think that's going to...
I think it's a big part of where things are going.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to see, like, you see your younger clients actually thinking of, you know, putting their money in. Do you see that?
I don't, because my younger clients work through me, and I don't work on individual things.
Oh,
yeah, okay. I work through a fund or a managed
asset.
There might be a
fund out there though.
I know there is,
artificial
intelligence.
I'm pretty sure.
Probably in an ETF, an exchange traded fund.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm referring to.
An AI ETF.
Dabbling in those. But do you think that's a...
I think it's one way to go. I mean, but you better be ready to take the ride.
Yeah.
They're sectors.
I'm young now, so I figured.
Yes,
you know,
yeah. But it's a sector, and so, you know, anything sector based, anything that's just purely one thing is gonna, you know, be very volatile.
High risk.
Yeah. But if it's just a piece, that's okay. And if you can lose it, do it.
Wow.
You know,
I only have about 6 shares.
That's okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
What are some of the things you invest in or would advocate investing in?
Well, because I take a planning approach, I'm really big and I'm conservative and I'm a woman. So there you go. And I'm really, you know, everyone can tell I'm a woman, I hope. But I tell, you know, all my clients, look, I'm already going to tell you, I'm out the gate, I'm conservative. And I'm a woman, and I, you know, I'd rather have you hate me for not making too much or enough than hate me for it going all the way over the cliff, you know, because, and am I ever going to do anything with your money? I tell people no, because I don't want to go to jail. It's hard enough if you're upset with me. I don't want to go to jail, so I'm never going to run off with somebody's money.
Right.
But I use the fund. I have one account in a managed asset platform, and then I have another account in a direct mutual fund platform, both of which I recommend to my clients. So that we use in our office. While we can use the universe of products out there, we are only two people with only so much RAM memory. So we, you know, we figured out our product lines and what we like and what works. So, and I kind of explained, you know, in the investing world, my opinion is a lot of things are, it's kind of like Wendy's, Burger King, McDonald's, everybody in and out, they all have their, you know, Big Mac or Biggie, and you know, it's all the same stuff just in different order, you know. So one thing you need to know when you go into investing, especially if you use funds, and I see this oftentimes with people in 401ks, if I review their 401k, they've got a lot of overlap. So they own, you know, they don't pay attention to if the company has, or the provider has sectioned off the types of investments. They buy, you know, three things in the large cap growth, and then, you know, one thing down here. I'm like, well, you're totally overweighted up here. It's not diversified. Yeah, it's not diversified. So we diversify for people.
So if you're trying to, like, work in finance, what kind of qualifications or just career paths should you kind of take?
Well, obviously, religious studies did it for me. So you have to have a lot of stick-to-itiveness. You got to, you know, be good with people and just be willing to keep learning.
Are there, like, certifications that are desirable in that field?
You know, we interviewed somebody on the phone yesterday that's getting graduating in personal finance from Fresno State, and you know, he had a lot of customer service background, which we both liked, and so, you know, I'm not, I would not hire somebody just because they had a background in finance. You know, book finance is way different than dealing with you and your personal situation. And while the concepts are the same, you know, and it helps to have that background. I spent a lot of time having to learn it on my own because I didn't take it in school. It helps, but it's not required. Really, it's just the, in my opinion, this is my opinion, you know, just the stick-to-itiveness, ability to learn, be good with people, and live a little lean in the beginning, because it takes some time to develop a clientele. It's heavy startup costs when you're, you know, on your own. If you see $6,000 a year minimum, that's $7,000 a year just for me to maintain my licenses and my insurance and all that. Then you have office overhead, then you have expenses, advertising, blah, 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 that kind of stuff. So you're starting a business. Unless you go connect with a wirehouse and their training program, and they do have them, it'll just be a different it'll be more of a transactional sales approach as opposed to planning, which is where we kind of take our business. But good question. Okay, somebody else has to ask a question. These guys are driving the thing now. Yeah.
So if you have to be underneath a company,
you have to be supervised.
Edward Jones or something like
that.
How would somebody go about creating a new company like that, like an Edward Jones?
Oh, wow. Got to have a lot of access to capital.
Well, yeah, but, how do they get certified or?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. I don't know. My broker-dealer up in Fresno, SCF Securities, which is an awesome little broker-dealer boutique, you know, caters to folks like me. They were folks like me, and then they branched out and became a broker-dealer. So there's a boatload of licenses that you have to obtain to do that, and a boatload of insurance. Oh God, yeah. It's at a different level, I think. I don't know. It's a legal piece. I don't, you know. It's just like too much to know in my world. I can't know that too. So it's a good question, but I might see you one of these days. It sounds like. Yeah.
I'm curious. With all this regulation and all these licenses and all this people overseeing, how did we have such a mess in 2008?
That was at a whole other level. That was at the mortgage level. That was all the crappy mortgage tranches that were being
sold. We go into great detail in that in ethics class because we use that as an example. And I could talk to you more about it later, but it had a lot to do with political pressure, people not doing the right thing, deregulation,
greed.
Short-sighted planning, you know, making decisions based on a short-term return, not thinking about the long-term consequences.
Yeah. Christian Bale made a movie about it.
It's actually really informative. It's called The Big Short.
There's a movie.
That, you know, and I'm not saying the industry is perfect because nothing is, but there are a lot of, you know, measures that were put in place as a result of that.
That's what happens. Every time you have deregulation and things kind of go crazy, they realize it doesn't work and they put in more regulation.
Banks got bailed out and all that outcome.
A lot of bad things happened.
Yeah.
Well, still, it's the ripple effect.
It is. Another question? 401k, 403b, so here's my little soapbox since I get to be in front of young people. And I'll finish up. When you go to work, start your 401k, 403b. I still remember I worked for a Head Start program here in Visalia for 5 years. I was under the Office of Education. The lady came over. Somebody said, you need to go in that room and talk to that person about starting your 403b. And I said, no, I'm too young. Yeah, right. I was in my 20s. That was the perfect time to start it. No one told me why, and no one told me how it worked. And, you know, so I'm real big on, you know, don't make my mistake. If I had started back in my 20s with my 403b program at $50 a month, which I certainly could afford at that time, I would be in a far different place than I am now because it's really hard to make up money with time. But if you have a lot of time, you can have a lot of money if you start early. And I tell everybody, start with your qualified investing first. That's my opinion. I'm not going to get into a debate with you about Roth versus traditional IRA because the numbers bear out. They're about the same at the end of the line. The point is that you start your investment program as early as possible and just start it. That's the hardest part. Get away through all that stupid paperwork and figure out what you're going to invest in and all that stuff. Use a target date fund, you know, those kind that you know, into the future, age-based funds, if nothing else. Those are easy and done for you, just do it, but the point is start. So if all of you will start, you'll be far ahead than anybody else in this building. 401k, 403b, private, public, maximum amount you can contribute is 19,000. I have to look at my number again. It's a lot of money. On a pre-tax basis, it doesn't cost that much. Never get into the trap of, oh, I got dinged on taxes, I'm gonna up my or lower my exemptions to pay more taxes and pay extra to the government. Pay it to your 401k or your 403b. Work with your HR department and work that out, or do a payroll calculator or simulator so you can see the benefit to you. Don't give it to the government if you don't have to. So, question?
Was that number yearly or monthly on the
annual?
Okay.
Annual, yeah. It's 25,000 maximum if you're over 50, so it's 19,000 because there's 6,000 catch up. So it's 19,000 maximum this year. 7,000 maximum for IRAs and Roth IRAs.
If you're just starting out, there's a lot of young people in this room. What's the best way to really start building your credit?
Paying on time, student loans, paying on time, getting a small credit card and paying that on time. Not paying it off, but paying it on time. So putting a couple $100 on it, paying it off.
So you think they should always keep, don't they talk about this idea of debt to ratio,
debt to
credit, and they, what do they say, one third or less?
Yeah, generally speaking, yeah. Good question. Well, it's about 11, so I'll close up. And, yeah.
Sorry.
Okay.
I know that a 401k is like retirement, but I don't know exactly what it is.
Sure. A 401k is an employer-sponsored, so the word is employer-sponsored plan. That means so let's just say you work for ABC Enterprises and they have sponsored a 401k provider. So let's just say they use XYZ ABC company. And that company, they hire that company to come in and help the employees defer money ahead of taxes. So it just runs through payroll over to the plan sponsor. And just so you know, that money is not under the control of the employer. It's yours. It's all yours. So any money that you put away through your payroll goes to the plan sponsor, and it's your money at the plan sponsors. So if the company goes under, the only thing that might be lost is a match that maybe they promised to make. And don't not contribute if you don't have a match. In other words, contribute anyway, and if you get a match, that's even better. And remember, sometimes matches are vested, typically on a 20% per year basis. So if the employer's putting in an extra, whatever, let's just say $1,000 a year for you, then, you know, it's gonna take you 5 years before that contribution is fully yours.
Oh.
Okay, and if you leave early, you typically will leave some of that behind.
We'll get into all
of
that.
Yeah,
okay.
Pay attention on that one because it's really good information. And don't be the ignoramus that says, I'm not gonna contribute because my company doesn't match. Boy, you want to see steam come out of my ears when somebody says that. I'm like, really? You know? So, you know.
But it's really bad if they're willing to match and you're still not willing to put
in. And you don't contribute at least the minimum. I mean, that's not hard to do. All of us here can afford the minimum. Every single person here. You can afford it. You'd be amazed how much you wouldn't even miss it once you get it going. So,
because the match is just free money.
The match is free money, yeah. And it's typically 2 or 3% of your contribution up to a maximum. So,
when I worked at Lowe's, they did 7%.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, that's excellent. Did you contribute?
Oh, yeah.
Good. Good for you.
I just did like 12%.
Good for you. Yeah, good for you. Good for you, yeah.
So if you leave the job, that still stays with you?
That's your account, yes. And so if you leave the job, your options are to roll it into your next 401k, if you have it, or put it in an IRA, which you would open with somebody like me or maybe at the bank or something.
Okay.
Yeah. Don't ever leave money behind. Ever. Let me tell you why. Two reasons. You'll move and you won't update your address. I've seen that happen. Or the plan sponsor will change, because they do change occasionally. And what they'll do is they'll liquidate your assets from the portfolio that you may have really loved and put it in cash and then wait for you to reallocate it, and you won't get around to doing it because you've moved and you haven't updated your address and your statements don't find it. It's a mess. So never leave money behind. Always take it with you in some form. Don't cash it out.
Yes, don't
cash it out. What's the penalty if you take money?